Welcome to The Spot, KALW's showcase for the best in public radio podcasts. First up this week, it's Radio Ambulante, compelling human stories from around Latin America and the United States. Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.
This is a Chicano Renaissance. We're going to win the court battles. We're going to win the battles of public opinion. We're going to win on the artistic side. We're going to win in the history books. And we are updating the American dream.
Welcome to Radio Ambulante Unscripted, a new way to listen to Latin America, part of Soundworks from PRI. I'm Daniel Alarcón. So if you've been paying attention to the immigration debate, you know at least some of what's been going down in Arizona. You probably heard about HB 1070, the so-called Show Me Your Papers bill, which was deemed unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. And maybe you heard about right-wing darling Sheriff Joe Arpaio under investigation by the Justice Department. But maybe this slipped under your radar. In the realm of public education, there's been another fight underway. It started in May 2010, when Arizona House Bill 2281 ended ethnic studies, in the process banning some of the most beloved and important books in the Latino and Latin American canon. Luis Alberto Urrea, Sandra Cisneros, Rudolf Anaya, Dagoberto Gilb, these were just some of the authors whose work was banned. Writer and activist Tony Diaz was among those who were outraged by this. He and his allies organized a caravan to smuggle some of these banned books back into Arizona. And since then, Tony, El Libro Traficante, Spanish for book smuggler, has become one of the leaders of a nationwide movement in favor of Mexican-American and ethnic studies. I recently spoke with Tony about this movement and about how it all got started, but first I wanted to know more about Tony's experience growing up in Chicago.
Actually, my folks were pickers in Texas. But I was lucky enough to have come into existence after they had moved to Chicago, so that my childhood was very different than my siblings, because all of them had to pick. They were picking everything from alfalfa, tomatoes throughout Texas, even Michigan. But I grew up on the south side of Chicago. I think a lot of the activism I've actually learned, and actually the rhetorical analysis I've studied, I got in Chicago early on, and I remember too, everybody in Chicago was in a political party, union, or a gang, and it everything was in terms of territory, who you belong to. But I think what I also learned is how these groups worked, because at that time I could go from one group to the other to the other to the other. And I think it was because of the language skills I was developing. Yeah, and actually what was wild about Chicago, too, it was ethnic Chicago. So even in Bridgeport, it was Italians, Irish, and the Lithuanians had just moved out, and Mexicans were starting to move in. So we were a part of those first early families. That was an interesting moment in time for Chicago, which kind of shaped the way I look at the world and it was the multicultural world. So, yeah.
It's like you came up in a multi-ethnic, multicultural reality where a lot of your immigrant friends were one way or another negotiating similar, you know, cultural terrain as you, even if their home language was Italian or Polish or whatever, right? And it's interesting to me because a lot of the charges that have been leveled at, you know, Chicano studies or Mexican-American studies is that it breeds this kind of hate. You know, it breeds this kind of like separatism and anti, you know, whatever. Right. And it strikes me as we do just talking to you, you know, it's like I get right away that that's not at all where you're coming from, that you're coming from a polyglot urban culture that, you know, you had grew up with Irish and you grew up with Italian and you grew up with all kinds of people. And so how do you square that? Like, how do you understand those charges that have been leveled against this discipline? And sort of mesh that with your own experience.
The Tucson Unified School District had the Brilliant Mexican-American Studies program in place. I guess it was about 6 years after the Department of Justice forced Arizona to implement culturally relevant courses. I think the far right Republicans had time to study it, and they practiced. I guess one thing is sometimes these attacks seem sophisticated. It's just that some of these oppressors have time and energy to think about it. And what they came up with was to scare folks who are not familiar with Latinos or Chicanos and who don't know what goes on in a classroom, they were able to come up with a scare tactic that says these courses breed resentment. And what I had grown up learning was that for me to navigate all these different experiences, it was better to be around all these different folks. And to me, I had learned so much from it that it's inspired a lot of my work. And really what we as Libre Traficantes profess is quantum demographics. And the idea is that if I'm fulfilled with my history and culture, I've got the wisdom and intellectual framework to build bridges between different cultures. And that's really the result. And I think that's why ethnic studies is so valuable and critical thinking is so valuable. But we're going to look back at this era and quaintly remember, oh, so people were scared of kids reading books? We'll be like, yeah, isn't that crazy? Because, you know, you just got to look back at history. Like Cleopatra, she spoke so many different languages, knew so many different cultures. You know, it's all these eras where people did that because they were international cities and figures. I think half of it is just we've been able to study a lot of what happened in Arizona, and I think we've gotten organized because of that.
Yeah, yeah. I want to talk about Arizona because I want to talk specifically about HB 2281. And that's what sparked this Libro Traficante madness, right? I mean, that's what sent you on this adventure, mm-hmm. correct?
When Arizona got crazy and banned Mexican-American studies, and we heard about it through multimedia, we heard the students wanted their books back. We organized the 2012 Libro Traficante caravan to smuggle the banned books back, and that was a six-city tour. We had people donating books from all around the country, over $20,000 worth of books. We started 4 underground libraries, and we were happy to have handed the books to the students in Tucson. But that also exposed us to this attack on ethnic studies and critical thinking in particular. And before Arizona banned Mexican-American studies, I had founded a group called Nuestra Palabra, Latino Writers Having Their Say, back in 1998. So that group had been about 12 years old at the time. But it turns out we had actually been working with most of the writers who would wind up getting banned in Arizona. And as we looked at the list of authors, in fact, on our website, libertaficante.com, there is a link to an annotated bibliography to all 84 books that were in the curriculum. Go down the list, and we've either brought them to Houston or had them on the radio show or worked with them in some way, shape, or form. So that, you know, basically I called Dagoberto Gil. I'm like, hey, brother, you're banned in Arizona. And he's like, I'm so honored. And then Brian Parras, one of the other Libre Traficantes caravan founders, he said, well, let's do a caravan. And actually, I came up with the word. What's fascinating to me is that I had come up with the word Libre Traficante after one of our book fairs. So it's like midnight. We're breaking down one of the shows, and we're behind the George R. Brown in the dark with trucks and boxes. And I was like, you know, if a cop pulls up right now, they'll be like, all right, what are you guys doing? We'll be like, we're Libre Traficantes, right? Like, you know? And that word had been there, but it didn't gain currency till we actually had to smuggle them.
There's a performance aspect to the character of Libre Traficante with the shades on and the, like, you know, you look like a... Like, you know, you're in the background of a Goodfellas or like an Al Pacino movie or something, you know? There's like that image too is like, you know, it's performance, and it's incredibly effective as performance, you know, because it points out the absurdity of banning books. Is that a character or is that you?
You mean, am I really the Libre Traficante? Do I talk like that, act like that? You know what? It's a little bit of me, right?
What is it like? Like, take the book, leave the cannoli, you know?
That's right. You know, it's rhetorical analysis. No, it is performance. But I think what's been beautiful about this journey is I really think everything I've ever done in my life has been practiced for these moments.
Tell me about the students you've met, in specifically in Arizona, where I feel like perhaps more than anywhere else in this country, you know, Mexicans, Chicanos, Latinos generally, but specifically Mexicanos are under attack. And so tell me about the young people you've met in Tucson.
To me, when we talked to the students in Tucson, even as we were organizing, what was powerful is just how well-versed they were, how much they knew about their culture. So you've got, you know, young organizers who have critical thinking skills, who know how to organize and know their culture. People need to keep up to date, too, because there's two high school Chicanas. Two Chicanas in high school are taking the case against HB 2281 to the Ninth District Court of Appeals in the fall. And everybody's freedom of speech is riding on their backs. And, you know, Maya Arce, who is a teenager, and she is a strong advocate for our community. You know, I guess my parents picked fields when they were teenagers. Now our young have to go to the Supreme Court to defend our culture.
It seems to me there's a political fight ahead and there's a legal fight ahead. But there's also a public opinion fight. And I was just wondering if looking forward, do you think that's the I mean, maybe cultural fight is the way to say it. But do you think that that's the fight you're going to win, the public relations fight, the court of public opinion, as they say?
Oh, I have no doubt that this is a Chicano renaissance. Our culture was on the brink of extinction and House Bill 2281 was one sign of that moment. But this is a Chicano renaissance. We're going to win the court battles. We're going to win the battles of public opinion. We're going to win art, because only art can save us. We're going to win on the artistic side. We're going to win in the history books. And we are updating the American dream. If you look at historical cycles, every 40 to 50 years, you got to reboot democracy. And that job is falling on the broad shoulders and broader imaginations of Chicanos this time around. And we're inspiring people to think, to feel, to adapt. And that's what's exciting about this movement. And it is the updating of the American dream. So what's exciting is that on our watch, we get to see all this come to pass.
Tony Diaz is a writer and activist. He is the founder of Nuestra Palabra, Latino Writers Having Their Say, and the author of The Aztec Love God. This interview was produced by Silvia Viñas. Special thanks to program associate Lori Ignacio and production intern Diana Buendia. The Radio Ambulante team includes Martina Castro, Camila Segura, Luis Treyes, and David Pastor. Carolina Guerrero is executive director. Thanks also to Productora Sonica in Bogotá. Radio Ambulante Unscripted is supported in part by PRI's New Voices Fund, bringing new perspectives and personalities to public media. Donors to the fund include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation. Radio Ambulante tells the stories of Latin America. To hear more, visit our website, radioambulante.org. There you'll find links to our stories in Spanish and more content in English, too. I'm Daniel Alarcón. Thanks for listening.
Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.
What set you playing?
You're listening to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts.
DIY.
Welcome to Destination DIY. I'm Julie Sabatier. We're continuing our Oregon Inventor series with inventors who've done some pretty amazing things before even graduating from high school. From cats to semiconductors, these very motivated teenagers were inspired to tackle a variety of challenges. And for the most part, they did it on their own.
DIY means doing yourself. Sometimes I can do without help. DIY means I try to do it all by myself. La, la, la.
17-year-old Bailey Delante and her family are really into sharks. The Delante household tunes in religiously during Discovery Channel's annual Shark Week. One particular story really stuck with Bailey. While boogie boarding, a boy got attacked by a shark that bit off his leg. He lost so much blood that he couldn't swim ashore. It was the horrified looks on the faces of the boy's family that really affected Bailey.
I would hate for my parents to see that, or like if I had to see that happen to my sister, and it was just like, is there a certain way that we can prevent something like this from happening?
And even though shark attacks are rare, she thought if she could just save one person, it would be worth it. so she came up with a very practical solution.
I invented a wetsuit that has tourniquets in the arms and the legs, over the auxiliary artery in the arms and the femoral artery in the legs.
Bailey is quick to point out that the suit would also protect against other kinds of accidents.
Say if you're injured in the water either by a propeller or you're cut or you're bitten by a shark, you grab the strap on either arm or leg and then you pull it and it activates the tourniquet, constricting the blood flow so you don't bleed out.
One of her teachers encouraged her to enter a contest for student inventors in Central Oregon where she lives. She was surprised when she won the $500 first prize. And Bailey's parents are so excited about her project that they're working on getting it patented. Her mom, Lorinda, has big dreams for the tourney suit.
Hopefully it goes all the way. Bailey wants to become a doctor, so it'd be really nice if it paid for the Ivy League college that she wants to go to.
Bailey is actually not the only teenage inventor submitting an application to the patent office. There are kids doing amazing projects all over the country and the world. The thing about kids is they're able to look at long-standing problems with a fresh perspective, and they're not intimidated by the unknown. It's hard to imagine Harsha Upili could be intimidated by much of anything in the world of science. As a high school senior, he was getting up early in the morning before school to read articles about the latest advances in device physics. When he saw a press release from the Harvard School of Engineering and Applied Sciences with the headline,
"Synaptic Transistor Learns While It Computes,"
he jumped right in.
As soon as I saw the title, read the first few lines, I knew that is what I wanted to do. I knew that's what I'd be devoting most of my time to.
Okay, so a transistor is a basic component of any electronic device, and a synaptic transistor is one that works like a synapse in the human brain. With my very limited knowledge of electrical engineering, this basically sounds like magic to me. Harsha did his best to explain.
Synapses dominate the architecture of our brains. The stronger the synapses, the more capabilities we have. So I wanted to mimic that principle of ionic conduction in my field effect transistor. And so then every time I applied a pulse of voltage to my device, it had a higher peak output. It could do more. It was teaching itself. It was learning. You don't find that in a normal device.
Harsha's project didn't just mimic what the Harvard researchers had done. He created his own synaptic device using different materials than the Harvard guys used. And he took the idea further by creating a mathematical modeling system to demonstrate the viability of his device. By any standard, his project is, in a word, advanced.
I used a plasma-enhanced chemical vapor deposition to induce a silicon dioxide layer that was heavily phosphorus-doped. And the phosphorus-doped enables for the ionic conduction analogous to a synapse, because phosphorus, when exposed to H2O...
I got in touch with someone who actually understands what Harsha is talking about. Jian Shi is a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard, and he's one of the researchers who created the original synaptic transistor project. Jian took a look at Harsha's work, and he was impressed.
I was surprised that he had very great understanding and deep understanding on such kind of semiconductor devices, and also its emulation on human brains.
Well, what kind of grade would you give him if you were grading this paper, if he was your student?
Yeah, A. Yeah, A.
You'd give him an A?
Yeah, yeah. Straight A, yeah.
But remember, Harsha is not a graduate student. He hasn't even started college yet. He worked on this project alongside a normal class load, including calculus, microbiology, and post-colonial literature. And he held his own on the varsity tennis team at his high school.
Every day of winter break would be 15-hour days. Every day off from school would be 15-hour days. Some day, Fridays, even Thursdays, I'd spend 6-7 hours in the lab.
Do you remember that moment when you were like, oh my gosh, it works?
Yes, I do. It's especially after spending so many hours just theorizing and wondering, and there's always that doubt, did you do this properly? Especially when exploring the unknown, exploring innovation. When I saw the result, that I saw that every time that there was an increased pulse, I just sat there gleefully just enjoying the moment. I probably didn't touch anything for the next half hour.
Harsha took his project to the Intel Northwest Science Expo, where he won Best in Fair. That qualified him for the International Science and Engineering Fair, or Intel ISEF. It's an annual gathering of winners from regional fairs around the world, about 1,700 kids competing for top prizes in more than a dozen categories. Harsha ended up taking home multiple awards for engineering and innovation. He also got a special award from NASA.
It's almost like a rock concert in a way, so...
The first place award winners in engineering, materials, and bioengineering are...
So they'll say, from Portland, Oregon, Harsha Upili.
From Portland, Oregon, Harsha Sudarsan Upili.
In the video from the award ceremony, you can see Harsha decked out in a suit, sauntering up to the stage with one hand in his pocket. As he approaches the front of the room, he can't help but grin around his braces, slapping his hand over his heart. Is it frustrating for you that you did something so cool that you can't, like, necessarily explain to a lot of people? Like, when we first got here, you know, we saw some people in the hallway and they asked you what you had there in your hand, and you sort of said, oh, it's a little science project.
Well, it is a little science project. That is not false. I mean, I'm proud of what I did. I don't expect everyone else to be, like, very interested in it. Not really.
I think it's fascinating.
Oh, thanks. So, I do too.
Harsha just graduated from Oregon Episcopal School in Portland, and he's headed to Georgia Tech in the fall. Here at Destination DIY headquarters, aka the spare bedroom at my house, we have a little bit of a cat problem. Like most felines, my two cats, Miles and Roxy, expect to be the center of attention at all times. And they can't understand why Destination DIY engineer Brian Kramer won't pet them. Brian has some pretty serious cat allergies. And as a precaution, we've made the guest room / studio a cat-free zone. I recently learned that some cats are more likely to trigger allergies than others. Unfortunately, we don't know where Roxy and Miles fall on that scale. But what if there were a way to find out just how much a particular animal would affect someone with allergies? At 17, Savannah Tobin had the same question. She's always been a cat lover, but her mom is allergic to cats.
And so I did some, like, research and found out that there are, like, certain breeds of cats that are supposed to be, like, anecdotally hypoallergenic, meaning that, like, they don't cause allergies.
Savannah ended up adopting a Russian blue cat named Safira. Safira didn't aggravate her mom's allergies at all. That piqued Savannah's curiosity.
And so then I kind of started looking into that and found out about, like, how there's a protein called FLD1 or Felis domesticus 1, and it's in cat saliva, and then when they're grooming themselves, they're coating their bodies in the protein.
So when people are allergic to cats, it's the cat's saliva and not their fur that's actually causing the reaction.
And so then I hypothesized that maybe not all cats were producing the same amount of this protein, because if some cats were causing allergies, but, like, Safira doesn't cause her any allergies, then I thought maybe there was something I could do to figure out if I could quantify the amount of protein so we could, like, distinguish between cats.
Savannah volunteered at the Willamette Humane Society in Salem. She thought that a test for this protein that causes cat allergies might help spur cat adoptions.
So if, like, random stray cats have, like, the possibility or the capability of being just as kind of hypoallergenic as the purebred cat, then if people knew that, they could adopt those cats. And, like, that's just access that we don't have. We just don't know about it yet. But if you could shed the light on that and, like, have the information available, then that could connect a lot of people with animals that they, like, didn't think they'd be able to have.
Savannah took her idea to her science teacher at West Salem High School, and he helped connect her with Allison Fisher.
And I'm an associate professor in the Department of Chemistry at Willamette University here in Salem, Oregon.
Allison agreed to let Savannah use her lab space over the summer to test out her hypothesis.
And then it was just a step-by-step process, and nothing worked at all, ever. It was terrible.
Savannah spent hours in the lab, all through June and July. She got some technical help from Allison, but Allison primarily works with plants. So she suggested Savannah contact some other scientists who had experience testing human saliva using a similar method.
And she just emailed them and told them a little bit about what she wanted to do and asked them if they thought it might work, and got some suggestions from them as well. And I thought, you know, there are very few high school students who would just cold email a distinguished professor like that. She obviously came across as somebody much more mature.
After 2 months of lab work with no successful results, Savannah had a breakthrough.
And I was kind of freaking out. I was like, this is like so fantastic because nothing has worked for 2 whole months. And like, obviously that's not a really long time, but I was like 18. I was like, that's forever in my world, but it's not really. But I was like so excited because it meant that like there was possibilities for the future.
And Savannah wasn't the only one freaking out in the lab that day.
I remember looking at the data and my first response was, oh my gosh, it f***ing worked.
Savannah continued to work on her project in the lab for hours after school, all through the fall and into February.
It was just like a given that I was like the cat person scientist that just wasn't doing high school work. I was like doing my own thing. This was pretty much my life, and like I just went all in.
That hard work paid off. Like Harsha, Savannah also got to take her project to Intel ICEF. She won first place and best in fair in the biochemistry category. She got some scholarship money and a trip to Sweden to attend the Nobel Prize ceremony.
You think it's like a special thing that like there's a high school kid working in like a lab and doing all this like sophisticated work. But then like in reality, there's like 1,600 other kids that are like doing it all across the country. It's pretty awe-inspiring.
She's just finished up her freshman year at UC Davis, where she's majoring in, what else, animal biology. Savannah acknowledges that there's still quite a lot of work to be done in order to verify her cat allergen test. She and her dad are working on filing a patent for it. She's not really that interested in the business side of things, but she does want her work to have a real-world application someday.
That's the whole point. That's the reason why I like tried to create this, so that people could get benefit out of it and like the animals could benefit from it.
Well, I know two cats and one sneezy audio engineer who could definitely benefit. Let us know when that test becomes available. Bailey Delante, Harsha Upili, Savannah Tobin. Remember their names. These are the innovators of the future. Whether you suffer from cat allergies or worry about shark bites, or you want a computer that works more like your brain, they've got you covered. And I can't wait to see what these kids come up with next. I'm Julie Sabatier. Funding for the Oregon Inventors Series comes from the Regional Arts and Culture Council.
D-I-Y.
Thanks for listening to The Spot here on KALW. You can learn more about everything you heard on today's show, as well as many other great public radio podcasts at kalw.org.